When Pete Sampras was just 12 years old, his father, who ran a restaurant, used to go to the automatic teller machine to get cash to pay for Pete's tennis lessons. Pete had one coach for his forehand shots and ground strokes, another for his serve, yet another for his footwork and balance. This athlete, who was considered the most inscrutable among champions, has written a book about his life and tennis career, but there's no mention in it of him ever playing sandlot baseball or going trick-or-treating. The book is called Pete Sampras, A Champion's Mind, Lessons from a Life in Tennis, written with Peter Botto. Pete Sampras, who won a record 14 Grand Slam men's titles, joins us from Beverly Hills, California. Thanks so much for being with us.
No problem.
People had their eye on you when you were about 8 years old, didn't they?
Yeah, you know, I was picked up a racket around 7 or 8, and my dad saw that I had some talent and took some lessons at a young age, and tennis was pretty much my life, but it was a lot of work, a lot of sacrifice.
So, I mean, are there occasions when you miss not going trick-or-treating or building a treehouse?
Well, I had an older brother who was 4 years older, and there were times when I was a kid when he would go out to the movies or to the mall, I'd feel a little jealous that I had a tournament the next weekend or I had a practice the next day, and, you know, maybe going to college was something that I missed.
And how old were you when you turned pro?
I was close to 17.
Let me ask you about a man who saw you play, kind of insinuated himself into your life as well as your career, and didn't leave for many years, and that's Peter Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
He was a doctor, and he saw you play?
Yeah, I was just moved to L.A. I was playing at the Jack Kramer Club, and I was hitting some tennis balls, and Pete, who's a tennis enthusiast, was watching me hit and really saw I had some talent and sort of befriended my dad. And then one thing led to another where he really started to coach me and teach me, and he switched my two-hand back into a one-handed backhand and really deserves a lot of credit for what he did for me. And it's sort of an odd story, you know, some guy that doesn't really know how to play tennis. He's a terrible tennis player himself, just started the base of my technique in my game.
There's a sad ending to this story, which we'll get to, but you said at the moment he walked into your life, he did a particularly valuable thing by ensuring that your father could stay your father and not become your coach.
Correct. I mean, my dad didn't know a lot about tennis. He was very involved in my tennis, but Pete sort of was in the middle of us and enabled my dad and I to have a really good relationship.
I want to linger a bit over the one-handed backhand, because
yeah,
when you were coming up, the two-handed backhand was becoming quite popular. What was the significance of Peter Fisher ordering you to use the one hand?
Well, I think it was a point in my junior career where I wasn't getting any better. I was sort of the typical counterpuncher, two-handed backhand, couldn't volley, couldn't serve, and Pete just sort of had this idea to get me to serve and volley. So I pretty much cold turkey went away from the two-hander and started hitting the one-hander. It was a tough decision, but I stuck with it. And I think it was just more of the big picture that he saw, was be more concerned about what I was going to be at 18 or 19 versus at 14. And so,
I mean, you lost some matches.
No, yeah, I lost matches. My ranking dropped. It was tough. I mean, for 2-3 years there, I wasn't having much fun. And, you know, my bar was Michael Chang, and I used to beat Michael. When I went to the one-hander, I started losing to Michael. And so whatever happened around 18, everything just exploded. I got bigger. I got a little stronger. I developed a good one-handed backhand. I developed a serve and volley game. And I, you know, look at my career, look at the Wimbledons that I've won, and feel like, you know, without making that switch, I don't know if I would have won a Wimbledon.
Let me ask you about some instances in your career. Wimbledon, 93. You were playing Andrew Foster, who was a low-ranked British player. And the crowd at Wimbledon pulling for the hometown guy. Now, you had the reputation of someone who never vented emotion. But you yelled something at that crowd, didn't you?
Well, I got caught up in the moment, and Andrew was the last British player. It was late. It was kind of a tricky match. And the crowd was certainly being pretty vocal. It was a smaller court, and I could hear a lot. And I just sort of wanted to get the match over with and just put my hands up in the air and just, you know, something completely out of character. I just sort of, you know, said a few things that...
This was strong stuff, I think it's safe to say.
Yeah, you know, you get caught up in the moment and the emotion of the match and the situation. You say a few things. Do I regret it? Absolutely. But it happened.
But let me ask, there was a press conference right after the match, which you won, and you were asked point blank if you'd said that.
Yeah, I froze up. I denied it. I didn't want to, you know, cause a distraction for me for the rest of the event. I was kind of caught off guard with it all.
You, of course, had a famous rivalry that persisted for years with Andre Agassi. And there you were, both the sons of immigrants, but you were often kind of cast in different roles, weren't you? Was that all the press invention, or were you, in fact, different from each other?
You know, I think we were pretty different. I mean, Andre was a little more flamboyant, outgoing. I was a little more introverted, and from our games to our personalities to our attire. But in the mid-90s, we're 1-2 in the world playing in major tournaments, and he obviously he was a great player, and he's still a good friend today. And as much as we were different, we got along pretty well.
Is it hard to be friends on the tour?
Very hard. I mean, it's an intimate sport. It's not like golf where they're competing against the golf course. You know, when I look across the net, I see a Boris, I see an Andre, I see a Courier. And so it's hard to really have those moments and then, you know, 2 days later go out to dinner or go play golf. I mean, we all handle it pretty well. But tennis is like boxing, you know. There aren't too many boxers that are good friends. So everyone sort of was to themselves and kept it pretty tight with their own entourages.
Let me, if I may, ask you about the Parting of the Ways. And finally, what happened to Pete Fisher, this man who, in your own account, you owe a great deal to.
Yes, yeah. I mean, he was sort of a tricky time. He had just turned pro, and Pete wanted to be involved in my tennis. He was very aggressive with sort of, you know, doing a contract. He wanted 50% of my winner's check. He wanted a Testarossa if I won all the Grand Slams in 1 year. I mean, it was pretty far-fetched, and this is where my dad got involved, and it got to be uncomfortable. Pete was a good friend of the family's and didn't want to travel. He was a doctor, and I felt like I needed some help on the road. And so one thing led to another. We kind of went our separate ways there for a while, but we still kept in contact. And then obviously, you know, he went through his own personal issues. And
well, we should explain, they, more than personal issues, they were legal issues.
Yeah, legal issue. He was accused of molesting kids, and this is in my middle of my career, and I was off doing my own thing. And
I mean, I have to ask, since we opened up this can of worms, you never saw the side of him when he was working with you?
No. He was part of the family. And looking back at it now, it was a little unusual. He would always sort of be at the club with, you know, teaching kids. And so you wonder, but you never thought it would be true. And I'm not sure if it is true. But he obviously...
Well, he did take a plea.
He did take a plea, you know, and I remember him telling me that he'd rather take a plea now rather than serve 8 years.
Mr. Sampras,
yes.
Why did you retire?
Well, I had nothing to sort of left to prove to myself. You know, after breaking the record of Grand Slams, I was pretty young at the time, and it kind of leaves your body, and when it does, it was time for me to move on.
And how are you feeling? Does playing at that level take a toll even years later?
I feel great. You know, I'm still playing a little tennis even today, and it's still fun for me.
Mr. Sampras, pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much.
Nice talking to you.
Pete Sampras, his new book, written with Tennis Magazine columnist Peter Botto, is Pete Sampras, A Champion's Mind, Lessons from a Life in Tennis.